Thank you for coming today to sit together in silence. And I know some have come from further away. Abby is coming from Marin to sit with us today. Thank you for making the long journey. Clara is coming from Monterey. Thank you for coming all the way. Anyone else from outside Santa Cruz? Precious opportunity to sit together. Also, this particular one-day sitting was billed partly as one of the one-day sittings for this Warming the Hearth program, this year-long kind of home-based practice commitment program. And a lot of people here are in that. So, as I previously mentioned, I thought we could talk about some of the teachings we've been studying in that group. These old teachings, the Pali Canon. Some say the closest to the original teachings of the Buddha. And we've been studying this book, In the Buddha's Words, an anthology of discourses from the Pali Canon. And several people have mentioned to me that these teachings don't, like, turn them on so much. They're not they maybe seem kind of dry, and there's a certain style, for sure, in these Pali Canon teachings. They're a lot of lists, numbered lists. That's how the Buddha liked to teach, I think partly for the sake of memorization. And very kind of straightforward, practical instructions. And they have a little kind of antiquated language. And we're nearing the end of this year of studying this book, so we only have like a chapter more, and then we'll move on to something different. And even for those who've had a hard time with it, I feel like I'm still happy that we got a chance to look at these teachings for this year. I think it plants a lot of seeds in our consciousness that even if we don't understand all what was going on here, I think some things seeps in, and these are the foundational teachings for the Mahayana and Zen. And partly I feel somewhat influenced by my practice for many years at San Francisco Zen Center. Some of the teachers there, maybe all of them, you know, at one point or another would teach from the Pali Canon. My teacher, Tenchin Roshi, led a couple practice periods on some of these Pali Canon sutras, Atasahara, as I recall. Zoketsu, Norman Fisher, is particularly fond of the Pali Canon. He collected different, his own kind of smaller anthologies, and there was a phase where he was really teaching that a lot at Green Gold's Farm. And Ryushin Paul Haller, before he came to Zen Center many, many years ago, he was an ordained monk in the Thailand Theravada tradition. He lived in Thailand, and with Theravada traditions based on these Pali Canon teachings. So he also, I know Atasahara, he did some practice periods of based on these kind of teachings. So it's not something new. It's part of our Suzuki Roshi Zen lineage, it seems, to look at these teachings. And even the Buddhas and ancestors sometimes quote from them, the Zen ancestors. So I just thought today, this one sutra from our recent reading caught my attention, And I thought, let's look at this with the intention to bring it alive. Let this turn us on and see how it's really, it's a bunch of old words, but how they're actually talking about what's happening right now and could be helpful. So this sutra is maybe not called, but the translator titles it, The Origin and Passing of the World. The Buddha says, Monks, I will teach you the origin and passing away of the world. Listen and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, venerable sir, the monks replied. The Blessed One said this, And what, monks, is the origin of the world? Independence on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of these three, the I and a visual form, or color, and I consciousness, the meeting of these three is contact. Those three come together. With contact as condition, feeling comes to be. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, existence. With existence as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair come to be. This, monks, is the origin of the world. It's provocative, I think. You know, this type of, especially to call it the origin of the world. So for some who have heard this kind of teaching before, this is a little subsection of the 12-fold chain of causation, or 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising. Dependent co-arising. My teacher once said, dependent co-arising is the Buddha's slogan. It's like, I mean, we could say that about various things the Buddha said, but it's one of the main things he taught. It so pervades the unique teachings of the Buddha. Evolved in the Mahayana to be one of the main teachings there too. And I just want to point out that, in case you haven't noticed this, that this dependent co-arising in this Pali canon teachings is like kind of a different thing than we often talk about in the Mahayana. Dependent co-arising, or interdependent origination, we often talk about in Mahayana and Zen teachings as like the interdependence of all things, the interconnectedness of everything. And and because everything is dependent on everything else, nothing inherently exists in and of itself, because everything is interdependent. And that is kind of like what Nagarjuna and some of these Mahayana teachers taught. But in these early teachings, dependent co-arising, it's the same principle that phenomena arise dependent on conditions, but it's talking about the dependent arising of suffering. Particularly, the dependent arising of suffering. And it doesn't go beyond that, really, in the Pali Canon, even though it's a very important teaching. It's this particular cause and effect way that suffering and discontent comes to be. Because that's one of the Buddha's main teachings, is we have this issue of discontent in our life. How does that happen? What is it, and how does it happen so we can work with it? So this is the model suffering dependently arises, dependent on various conditions, 12 conditions. This is the, so the 12-fold chain of dependent arising. And that's what this sutra is about. And it doesn't use all 12 here. It starts with the senses and objects, the ayatana. But it actually is talking about, in this particular sutra, that the dependent arising of the world. How does the world come to be? So I particularly resonate with this sutra because I think it has some precursors to these Mahayana ideas about mind only, that the world here depends on these kind of psychological interactions, how the mind works, when the eye organ meets a visual form and the eye consciousness, when those contact, that's the beginning of the creation of the world. So it's kind of unusual. Yes. No, no, I, like the I, E-Y-E, consciousness, yeah.
So strictly a physical phenomenon preceding the personality.
Yeah, preceding the personality. Well, depends what you mean by personality. You could say it's part of the personality, but as we know, there's no independent self identity. This is one of the Buddha's important teachings, but there is a personality, we could say, which is our unique, dependently arisen, karmic tendencies, you might say. That's what makes our personalities unique, is like the way we respond differently to different things, our preferences, our habit patterns. Those are, I think, what make our personalities unique, because in a way, like, we all have, all our eyes meet colors in almost the same way, unless we're blind or colorblind or something. So that is, in a way, I think that's part of it's part of being a person, the sensory, the five senses. But so in that way, we could say it's a little bit of our personality. But I think, like you said, we could also say it's pre-personality. It's before we're a unique person in the world. We all share these five senses. And then the way the five senses start to work with things and create habit patterns around the senses, that's what makes our unique personality. And some of that will come into this sutra. Yes?
Well, I know and assume that the Buddha knew this, but for me, this kind of conversation is, I find, useful and good in terms of dealing with our suffering. I think it takes some suspension of belief, because we start with the assumption of I.
Mm-hmm.
One can always ask the question, what was the origin of the I? And you can keep going back.
So, mm-hmm.
So we decide to agree, we'll accept the I, and then we'll have a conversation about what conditions continue that create this difficulty.
Or we can say we accept the personality. Again, we have to be careful with these words. Like the I, if we mean the I as some kind of like, oh, the I, that I, the E-Y-E. Yeah, 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 that's right. Yeah, yeah, it's true. That's like a...
Well,
exactly, exactly. We start there and work things out. Yeah, for the sake of like this particular discussion, and that's why there's, 84,000 teachings, they say, because we could start with some other supposition. Like there isn't an I. I mean, there are teachings that, like the Heart Sutra, that actually says there's no I. So that's another thing. But this is kind of pre-Heart Sutra too, where it says, let's just suppose that for our intents and purposes today, that there's an I. At least there's an experience of an I, and an I consciousness and colors. And I think, and again, like the Heart Sutra is. was, my understanding is, was given to people who already understood this early teaching of, like, that we kind of take for granted that there's an I, and it says, and we understand how this kind of works here, we could understand quite deeply and feel pretty good, like, yeah, I really kind of see how the world comes to be. And then the Heart Sutra comes along and says, by the way, your whole idea of, like, that there's an I and a color, there's actually no I and no color, and no world. But this is where there's an appearance of a world. This is one version of how it comes to be. Yes.
This is a recurring problem to me. So it's definitely the origin of the world, not our world. Because when you go through that, you know, mm-hmm. I consciousness, yes, of course. That's how
it creates our world.
My world.
Yeah.
My,
yeah. Yeah.
But
well, that's a good question, right? And because I think that from the Buddha's point of view, those are not two different things. There's not, like, the real world apart from me, the independent world that's out there, you know, exists in and of itself. There is, you know, experientially speaking, there is only my world and your world, and there's a lot of overlaps, we agree, and a lot of things about what we call the world. But strictly speaking, and that's part of, again, why this sutra caught my attention, because it's like, it brings in this issue of the world, which seems, mostly the other sutras are more just psychological, internal, and this is saying, really, is this how does the world come to be? Through my own mind's experience, and I think that's what's being proposed. The Buddha doesn't really elaborate on it there. He just kind of throws that in. Did you notice I'm actually talking about the origin of the world, but we're talking about that the world comes to be through beginning with the I meeting an object. So, yeah, I think we could say, are we talking about our world or the world? If we look really carefully, and this, again, kind of like, from, especially from these later Mahayana teachings, we start to see that we can't find the world as some independent thing, that we actually co-create our world. And again, I think the Buddha's very kind of pragmatic and very experiential-based. So I think a lot of these things are, like Richard said, let's not take for granted, like we all assume that there's the world. The Buddha said, let's not just assume that. Let's, like, really look really closely at our experience, and then we start to see, oh, okay, there seems to be a world. Well, how is my world that I'm experiencing come to be? Oh, actually, it starts with the senses and the mind. And then we might say, well, but there must be the real world, before I was here. And you could say, experientially speaking, we can't really say so. I mean, we can come up with scientific theories to try to prove it, but experientially, all we know is our world, and everybody else has theirs. And again, because we're the same species, we kind of co-create a very similar kind of world. So again, this is, what is the origin of the world? Independence on I and forms, the I and forms, I consciousness arises. So this is a little piece of dependent co-arising. It's important that it says independence. How does I consciousness arise? The visual consciousness arises dependent on various conditions, particularly depends on the eye organ and the visual forms and colors and shapes. Those three, actually, the organ, the organ or faculty, the field or object, and the consciousness, those three actually dependently arise together. It's not like So that's a good example of dependent co-arising, because it's not like there's colors out there, and then dependent on the colors that are already there, then an I and an I consciousness come to be. That's the little part about co, independent co-arising. Praticca samuppada. Sometimes we just say dependent arising, but that sam really does mean like together or co. Dependent co-arising means that there's not colors waiting for an eye to see them, and there's not an eye waiting for colors to appear. They dependently co-arise at the exact same moment. It's part of the... It might be some debate within different Buddhist schools, but that's the more most standard. So, and you could say, well, how do those dependently co-arise? Well, you can trace back further in this 12-fold chain, but in this sutra, the Buddha doesn't do that. He just says, independence, he starts with this because it's so basic. I think it's a nice place to start, is our five senses, or let's say six senses, because the six is the mental consciousness and conceptual thinking. It's a huge part of our life. And so here we are sitting for a day here, and our senses are operating. And if we haven't noticed that yet, if we sit here for the whole day, we probably will start to notice, particularly the physical sense. If we're uncomfortable while we're sitting, that's the body sense organ, the physical sense meeting the object or field is, you know, hardness or a cushion. Particularly that, you know, this is the fifth sense of these five physical senses is, you know, you could even call it like the skin organ, but it's not just the external skin. That's where we feel a lot of contact with object is on the surface, but also internally. Like if we have a stomach ache, that's the body organ and body consciousness meeting an object, which would be like the food in the stomach or another part of another muscle going on. So it's, I don't know, is the stomach part of the skin? Not exactly, I guess. But the whole physical body is sensate. You know, maybe not, right? So I don't know what science would say. Maybe like, you know, some internal part of the brain is actually not, like you can poke it with something and you don't feel anything. So maybe not every part is sensory. But we can explore this in sitting. Like, do you feel like your lungs when you're breathing have some, are there some like nerves? I guess it's not nerves, right? Again, I don't know physiology, biology here. It's not nerves, but yet, how is it that we actually can feel, or like our heart beating or lungs moving? What is it that actually senses that? Inside?
Yeah. For pressure. And you can also think of like our, when you're saying our, can we feel things inside? Well, actually our throat and stomach and intestines are actually kind of a continuation of the outside in a funny sort of way. It's a big hole.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
But yeah, so there's...
The inside meets the outside.
Nerves that some do pressure...
So deep inside the body, there's nerves. Interesting. Well, that's great to know.
Kind of buried within.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Our body, even our skin, that have less nerve endings. You know, like we have a lot on our fingertips. Certain places, like on our back. Space farther apart.
Yeah, so I think the Buddha, in the Buddha's time, 2,500 years ago, they didn't know a lot of this, right? They were just going with their experience. They didn't know about the nervous system. I think that they knew there was this whole kind of yogic subtle body channels and chi or prana that was, you know, even before the Buddha's time, people knew about that. So I think, again, through their experience, which is related, I think, to the nervous system. So now we can see that, the particularly the body sense, the fifth sense, is like closely related to the nervous system. But it's in our direct experience. I just like to think, like right now, I can feel these butt nerves meeting some firmness of a cushion underneath, and they contact, and there's a body consciousness. There's these five, six kinds of consciousness. There's a body consciousness that's the way that we know that experience of contact. And so eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, each of those five senses has its unique object and has its unique consciousness. The consciousness in this case is like a very direct experience. It just registers the contact, basically, in a very direct and unmediated and non-conceptual kind of way. At the same time, there's a conceptual consciousness that knows, oh, my butt's on a cushion down there, I can feel it. That's kind of a next step added in. Even before we do that, there is direct experience of that contact. So what's the origin of the world? In dependence on eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. And later he goes through all the other five senses. In dependence on ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. Dependent on nose and odors, dependent on tongue and taste, dependent on the body and tactile objects, and in dependence on the mind and mental phenomena, mind consciousness arises. So he goes through all those, but we're just take the eye as the first one here. Dependent on the faculty and its object, the consciousness arises. The meeting of these three is contact. So in this 12-fold chain of causation, that's how there's a few links before this happens that we're not going to discuss here. But one of those 12 links is called the six sense fields. Yeah, the six sense fields, which is like the object, and the six sense faculties. That's one of the links. Sadayatana. And then depending on those, there's contact. Sparsha is the next link. They meet. The meeting of these three is contact. With contact as condition, feeling comes to be. When those three contact, dependent on that contact, there arises a feeling, vedana. And this is not like an emotion kind of feeling. This is just this very raw, basic three types. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. There's no other types. Sometimes it's classified as, you know, there's six types. You could say six times three, and the six are for each of the sense organs. So there's a feeling, there's a bodily feeling, a visual, or maybe we should say a feeling based on body contact, a feeling based on eye contact, a feeling based on ear contact, and so on. And it can be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that's, I think, really neat to look at in our experience as we sit here, that notice that, like, okay, as soon as the butt organ contacts the cushion object, there's a feeling. Now, can you, because the feeling's dependent on that contact, could you have contact without a feeling? I think, strictly speaking, that you can. But it's very, very unusual. It's like our system is wired to just immediately generate a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral as soon as there's a sensory contact or a mental contact would be. The mind meets a concept. The mind organ meets an idea like I'm bored, and when the mind meets that, that's like an object. That thought is, it's a thought object. I'm bored. When they meet with the mind consciousness there, there's a feeling like, and that's kind of unpleasant to feel bored. It's more complicated with the conceptual, but it's the same principle. Yeah.
So I'm a little confused. Is this kind of objective, pleasant, unpleasant? I mean, because often we talk about like, dislike. Often confused about neutral. Is that that's good?
Yeah.
Or that's delusion?
Good question. I was thinking about this some, and this is something I think we can explore in our experience while we have a whole day to sit. What exactly is this feeling thing, actually? So traditionally, neutral, just to get that out of the way, is defined as, one way I've heard it defined is, it's like, it's a very, very subtle, pleasant or unpleasant, but it's so subtle that for all intents and purposes, we can't tell which it is, so we call it neutral. My teacher has explained it that way. Strictly speaking, there isn't really a neutral. But I don't know, I think other traditions might say, no, there really is a neutral feeling where it's right in between pleasant and unpleasant. We're talking about, you can get really very, very, not like great ecstasy or horrible misery, but it's just slightly pleasant or unpleasant. And I think it's a great thing to investigate. What is this in our experience? And as you say, what objectively? So yeah, this is before like our conceptual mind comes in and starts saying, I like this experience and don't like this. It's just this raw data, as the Buddha proposes. So it's also, it's the second skanda in the five skandhas, which are taught in order of like, kind of like, you could almost teach them in order of how they arise. So there's form, and then the feeling is before there's concepts and consciousness. At least before there's concepts. Maybe we'll leave consciousness out of it for now. So Dennis,
you just mentioned the mind object bored, and then this is kind of
or the thought bored. The thought this is boring.
Okay,
yeah.
So what about compassion? Isn't that also kind of, I wouldn't say unpleasant, but it's suffering, right?
To feel compassion. Again, I think. To say that feeling is not what we call an emotion, which I think I would define like emotion is a more complex combination of feelings and often thoughts, and maybe a mix of the five senses are woven in to create an emotion is a more complex thing. So I think compassion might be more like in this more complex thing, like an emotion that's based on thinking of someone else who's suffering, or ourselves who's suffering. So there's some conceptual, I think compassion is definitely needs conceptual activity. And so this is like before that. But we might say, in a moment of compassion, what's the basic feeling underlying it? And it might be a mix. And that would be another question we could have. Can you have pleasant and unpleasant at the same time? My understanding of these early teachings anyway is that I think they say it would say no. Actually, it might be quickly alternating, but at any one moment, there's it's either pleasant or unpleasant. Or, you know, maybe you could also say you mix the two together and you get the overall result. But it's a physical sensation, but it also could be mental. But it's the most raw, basic, pleasant or unpleasant. And I think when I look at this, I think this is a really amazing thing to look at in our experience. Because when you really start to explore what is this feel like, I'm feeling this unpleasant sensation. If you really start to like bore into it with your awareness, it's hard to say what it is. What is pleasant or unpleasant? You know, different people might experience something as pleasant and the same thing as unpleasant. But what is it that we classify it as pleasant or unpleasant? I think there's a lot of almost universal things for people, but not exactly. But what I think in my own experience when I try to do that, it gets really ungraspable and undefinable. Like I really, there's some like I'm aversion to this. I don't like this because it's unpleasant. But then why is it unpleasant? And I think it's if we start to really explore what is this very basic feeling or sensation of pleasant or unpleasant, it's like I think we're going back to like really primitive time and evolution, or like, you know, the reptilian mind or the limbic system, or, you know, before this. What's that?
I was just thinking it's kind of at the basic, you know, there's stimuli and response.
Yeah.
It's kind of that level of biology. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Of just the fact that you're alive.
Yep.
Certain stimuli, the organism, no matter what it is, you know, from single cell to, you know, a human being, will move away.
Yeah.
Just have kind of an automatic response.
Yeah.
And then other stimuli have a different response to.
And we don't know how, like very primitive, even like a fly or something. Do we say the fly has this vedana, this pleasant or unpleasant? And maybe there's a, we don't know, but maybe there's a really rudimentary something in there that makes it flee. Or maybe there's not a sensation, maybe it's wiring and programming is a little different than us. And it definitely, once you get into like mice and stuff like that, then we definitely see, I think that we say there's pleasant and unpleasant.
Well, yeah, because I mean, you can start with, you know, the amoeba level kind of.
Yeah. But is it just a response, or
it's
is it
just based on the fact that there's sensory, some kind of sensory system in the organism?
Like, is there
that initial response?
Yeah.
You know,
so feeling
higher levels of nervous system.
Yeah. So, at Liz.
To the things that are coded as unpleasant.
Yeah.
And the things that are coded as pleasant just kind of don't get a lot of perception around.
Yeah.
There's something deep that's kind of like self-protective.
Interesting. Yeah. Could be just like that. Mm-hmm. Could be. And that maybe through Zazen, as we start to become more and more aware, and we're kind of cultivating this relaxation and kind of like open kind of ease in Zazen, so that it could be that Zazen, if we're really open and relaxed in Zazen, that we're retraining our system to be more open to pleasant stimulus that we don't notice. So that's why I think sometimes, you know, to think, well, just sit down here and do nothing at all, and just be present. If it's not too physically uncomfortable when we're doing that, it tends to be, I think a lot of people find, I would classify it as pleasant, even beyond neutral. But even though there's no particular thing that's making it pleasant, right? Just to be present is pleasant. Often. So you could say that's our natural maybe birthright, is that actually there's this our kind of like underlying status quo is like actually maybe on the positive side, but when we're really busy all the time, we don't notice that underlying pleasant feeling of just being, because we're so into like I like this, I don't like this, more and more. It's a less, because this is a very subtle pleasure. The Buddha discovered that, right? He was doing all his austerity practices, very unpleasant. And they were unpleasant, he said. But he's like, I gotta, you know, somehow break through this body problem or something. And then he had this memory. I remember when I was just, as a kid, and I was just relaxed, and I just like settled into the present moment, and it was very pleasant. And he's like, could that be the way to enlightenment? And his first response was, no, I'm doing the austerity thing. If it's not if it's pleasant, big red alert. That's the ascetic approach. It's like, pleasure is great, is very dangerous, as we'll see in the next part of this paragraph, because we tend to get a hold of it. So no, and then he's like, wait a second, but that pleasure was like a different kind of pleasure. It wasn't based on some particular thing happening. It was just being. Like, maybe that is the way. Yeah, I think so. And that was the shift. Mm-hmm. Sure, go ahead.
Well, I guess it's somewhat of a practical question and also a rhetorical one, because we are training with all of these different teachings here in the West, and so there's the pleasant, unpleasant, don't know teaching, and then there's also the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral teaching. And, you know, these are perspectives from people who have a great deal of experience, and so... You know,
well, maybe those two are not that different, actually. We're talking about, the neutral or don't know. Mm-hmm.
It seems like, well, maybe there is this fulcrum, and maybe there's no fulcrum.
In a way, if we say it's either neutral or don't know, we can explore in our own experience. We can start to see, like, is there some very subtle, pleasant or unpleasant in this, what I was calling neutral, that I didn't notice until I'm really quiet like this? But in either case, I think these teachings are mainly working with what we can actually tell is pleasant or unpleasant. I think in some ways when there's a neutral feeling, it's not such a problem. Things are actually kind of okay with neutral. So I don't know if we have to figure that one out too much for now.
Somewhere just recently about the jhanas and these different, you know, stages of meditation and practice, and kind of related to what you were saying about compassion. They were saying that these kind of pleasant feelings were the Brahma Viharas, compassion is very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Three.
Yeah.
But the last one is you experience it in the later jhanas, which is equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the relationship between the neutral to equanimity.
I think that's true.
Is it the same thing, or is it just a matter of we just don't have that attention or that caring to the experience? It's all pretty much equanimous.
I think they are closely related. The Brahma Viharas are loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, which are all like cultivating kind of positive feeling. And then the last one is equanimity, which is more like neutral. So and also the progression of jhanas, which are these deep concentration states. The earlier ones are like already extremely deep concentration, right? The first jhana is very hard to realize, but the first jhana and the second go along with ecstatic bliss, actually. They have these different qualities. So one of them is, the first one's physically like blissful, and some people describe almost like you can barely stay in your body. It's like so blissful. And then the second is like the physical bliss becomes kind of in the way. So then it's a mental. The physical bliss turns into a more internal mental kind of joy. And as they progress deeper, the bliss goes, the joy goes, and they become just equanimous, neither blissful or unblissable, because even bliss is kind of a distraction from the task at hand, which is like really realizing what's going on here. So yeah, again, this is all in these early teachings, these where there's stages and so on. So anyway, the dependence on eye informs, eye consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is contact, with contact as condition, feeling comes to be. This is where we got to. With feeling as condition, craving. So this is the big step here. The big thing that we have pleasant or unpleasant, and then dependent on that, there's craving or desire, and you can guess which it's probably not for the unpleasant. it's basically wanting like more of this pleasant or less of the unpleasant, either more of it or for it to continue. And again, it's like, can you have pleasant or unpleasant without craving? Yes. But if craving does arise, it dependently co-arises on various conditions like our karmic tendencies and stuff. But its dominant condition, as I understand this 12-fold chain, the dominant condition, the main condition for craving is feeling of pleasant sensation. Or I think you could also say craving to reduce the unpleasant sensation is the same thing. It's not a given, yeah, which is why you can break the chain. They talk about this is 12-fold chain and it leads to suffering. You can snip it between any of these links, which is basically this can arise, but dependent on this, the next one doesn't have to arise, because they're only linked by interdependence, which is a kind of a loose thing. They're not like, this is caused by this. If there's a causal connection, it means it has to always happen. But dependence means there's other conditions too. You could say like, you have feeling, and then a pleasant feeling, and then you have also at the same time, you have, say, wisdom. And mindfulness, attention that's watching the whole thing. Dependent on the combination of feeling, wisdom, and mindfulness, craving maybe doesn't arise if you have those three together. So to let you hear, because the sutra I think does a really nice thing here. With contact as condition, feeling comes to be. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. So that's when it's like a solidification of the craving. It's like now we're getting a tighter hold on, I want this to continue. And the craving is just, I want it to continue. The clinging is like, I really want it to continue and I'm going to make it continue. And then, clinging as condition, existence or becoming, and that's a little harder to understand. But just for now, for brief, my one of my teachers, Ajahn Amaro, I really like his definition of this link, bhava or becoming. He says it's the thrill of getting what you want. So it's kind of like you've done it, you've grasped the thing, and I say yes. And that's what we call becoming, coming to be. You're like, it's a new moment. You've gone past the point of no return. You've become a new person. The thrill of getting what you want. You can contemplate that. Even if it's like, you might be like, I'm really in pain and zazen. I really want to move my leg, but I'm going to be patient. And like, you kind of like, I really am craving this, the relief from this painful sensation. You get to that, it's excruciating, then you move it, and it's like, ah, and this big kind of fresh breeze comes, and it's the thrill of getting what you wanted. Now you become a new being with a moved leg. I really think this is what it's talking about. It applies to everything, you know. With becoming, with dependent on becoming, birth arises. So it's like more and more solidification of like you're really here now, you're born as a new person in one moment. You could talk about it's multiple lifetimes, there's different commentaries, they go different places. Dependent on birth, as condition, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. This is suffering. So, yeah.
Because, mm-hmm. Because I guess I keep thinking of this in neurological terms, where you're adding more layers of the brain on.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, with human beings or higher mammals, I guess you could say, that whole kind of self-awareness,
mm-hmm.
kind of what we call consciousness or...
Yeah. But self-awareness.
Kind of like, yes, self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. Like,
so like as an I.
Yeah, as an I, exactly. So part of what's happening here... that this sutra doesn't even mention, is that the sense of the I, the independent self, is getting more and more solidified by this. So that's a great point. Even becoming this thrill of getting what you want, I think it's starting to reify the separate I, like, yeah, I got it. I did it. And birth is like, yeah, the birth of self-consciousness. I don't know if I've heard it said exactly that way, but I think that's a very nice way to look at it. Yeah, birth as like, now me, here I am. As soon as we have me, the me's got to get sick and die. So then basically the Buddha goes through the same sequence with the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And then he says, now what, monks, is the passing away of the world? Now, this is all about the origin of the world as we know it. Now, what about the passing away? That's the kind of like, how does the world as we know it cease? Independence, this is, I think, quite interesting, unique to this sutra. Independence on the eye informs eye consciousness arises, same as before. The meeting of these three is contact, same as before. With contact as condition, feeling comes to be. With feeling as condition, craving. All that's the same. But, now the Buddha says, but with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving comes cessation of clinging. So, I hear this as that you can snip this chain of causation between any link. So it sounds like it's snipping it between feeling and craving. I think he says, remainderless fading away of craving. So it's actually with the cessation of craving. And then you have the next ones. So it's like he says there's still feeling. There's the senses, the contact, and there's pleasant or unpleasant. And then that is why I'm hearing this is right there. We have pleasant or unpleasant, but we don't. Make the next step into like, I want this unpleasant to go away. That's the craving. Or I want this pleasure to continue or increase. That's the craving. So just like I mentioned earlier, of like, if you have the feeling along with, you know, wisdom and mindfulness, for example, that would be maybe then craving doesn't arise. You can actually practice like, on the secret, I like really want this. Well, what about just like resting in the unpleasant feeling? Just let it be. Mm-hmm. This is uncomfortable. So it's okay. So what? So that's, you just broke the chain at that point. And then just to finish this paragraph. Then basically you have the first links up to feeling are all the same, but then with the remainderless fading away of the craving comes cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of becoming. With the cessation of becoming, cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This, monks, is the passing away of the world. And then he does that with the other six senses. Yes?
Is that where awareness then leads to equanimity? Where you're okay with all of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You just can let that be in the kind of state that we are when we sit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the practice of equanimity breaks the chain. Maybe we shouldn't say break the chain because it sounds a little too forceful.
Yeah.
It's more like dissolving the links, or not even that's a little too much. Because you just look closely and you see there isn't really a fixed link in this chain. The chain is like it's just an image. It's just it's a hollow chain made of light. So you look there, it's like, oh, those seem to be like stuck there. The craving seems to be like, of course there's craving for a pleasant sensation. Well, maybe not. Yes. Yep. Retraining the mind. Yeah. Closely related, yeah.
Yeah, just this exploration of the nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, we're working with some really basic stuff like the nervous system and the physical body and the mind and how all that works together. I think it's just, there's some brilliant things that the Buddha discovered so long ago about how suffering comes to be. And he's trying to explain it in this really methodical, careful way. And so that's why these sutras can sound kind of dry and hard to take sometimes. But they're getting really detailed and specific. In Zen, we just say, just sit and drop off body and mind. Right? That's good. I think it's the same instruction, but it's less detailed than we might say, okay, just sit, drop off body and mind. Well, what's that mean? What do I do? I want an ice cream cone. So this is like, well, let's unpack it, and then we see, I think this is a detailed version of what it means to just wholeheartedly sit, which means just be with your experience completely, pleasant or unpleasant, and drop off body and mind, let go of craving for a different becoming, a different body and mind, and so equanimity, as we've said, and also patience, and maybe in some of this trauma work, addiction work, is cultivating patience with the unpleasant. I feel so, like, anxious. I just need a cigarette. I'll just be really patient with this feeling, like, okay. It's not going away, but, like, I don't need to, like, do the next step of lighting the cigarette. And then it's retraining the system. So then, like, it becomes easier and easier to become patient with that urge. But, not to make it sound too idealistic, this is hard work. Yes. Last question, Helen. Yeah. Yep.
And of course, everything is built on multiplicity of moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole thing. So even this whole 12-fold thing, which is, we didn't even get into the earlier parts of the fold, but I think this is the heart of it, as I feel. And but you could say all those 12 or the 6 factors are like in one, they all happen instantly. It's not like there's a little bit of feeling, here it comes, okay, pleasant, let's wait. It says craving. No, it's like, as soon as, you know, basically contact, you know, this a little bit of smell of French fries comes in, and immediately, like, I'd like some. You know, before we even think I'd like some.
It's just by virtue of having sensing organs.
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
yeah.
Living
things. Yeah. Yep.
We've got these sensing organs.
Exactly. And it's fine. It's normal, and it's, like, healthy that happens. But then if we start to study and we can unpack that finger snap into these 12 aspects, and we see, oh, it's so interesting to just study and watch how the mind works. I think if we stay, instead of like, oh man, we're never going to get out of this one. We're like trapped in this programmed sentient being thing. We're always going to want French fries when we smell them. But it's fine to want them too, right? But I almost feel like, just be curious. It's a spirit of just like, how interesting that I smell that smell, and like immediately that happens. Like, it's more like, and how wonderful to be a sentient being and be able to experience all of that like that. And then like, if we're curious and open and humbly acknowledging our sentient beingness, then we can just be like, everything becomes more flexible. It's like, okay, well, let's go get the French fries. Or like, oh, but they're, you know, the store just closed, the restaurant just closed. Okay, fine. That was interesting to experience. That I went all the way down there and it was closed, and it just closed. No problem. Was that a waste of time? No, I got to study my mind the whole way. So we have a day of this now. And this afternoon we can have a tea discussion and explore more. Some French fries. Cookie. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.